Hello folks, welcome back, and if you're a new listener, welcome to the show. I'm Simon Ward and you're listening to the High Performance Human Podcast. You might not realise this, but you are a high performance human. Now, this isn't just about your fitness level, your race results, and it's not even how you compare with those other endurance athletes you train and race with. Being a high performance human is about your whole life performance. Think of sleep, nutrition, exercise, relationships, or even mental health. And you don't have to be a high level athlete to excel at any or all of these. And we appreciate that you might still have room for improvement. And if so, then we'd love to help you. I've currently got availability to take on a few clients, and Beth, my wife, who's a certified life coach, also has some availability. So depending on what you're looking to focus on, we've got you covered, and you can find contact details in the show notes below. Let me ask you a question. Are you at all familiar with sailing, the America's Cup, or even the term cyclo? Well, I wasn't either, but you will be after you've listened to this week's guest chatting with me today, Dougal Allen. Dougal is a very accomplished multi-sport and triathlon competitor. He's won the New Zealand coast-to-coast event twice, which is a combination of run, kayak and mountain bike. And he's had many victories and top 10 finishes in 70.3 and full distance at both Ironman and Challenge events. And he's completed many multi-day adventure races around the world as well. He's also a very strong cyclist, and in the last 2 years he's put these skills to good use with a complete change of direction. He's now what's known as a cyclor, which is a hybrid word of cyclist and sailor, on board the 8-man crew defending the America's Cup for Emirates Team New Zealand in Barcelona later on this year. And in this conversation, we talk about his journey through multisport and triathlon to the America's Cup tryouts, focusing purely on bike power and building muscle. What exactly is a cyclor and what do they do on the boat? We also get into side discussions on things like head injuries and concussion, healthy habits to maintain high performance, and whether Dougal is the sort of person who trains to race or races to train. It really is a fascinating discussion and a totally different conversation to ones I normally have, so I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Dougal, thank you so much. Much appreciate you staying up late to chat to us all the way from New Zealand. It's great to have you on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. It's nice to be here. I appreciate you inviting me to speak to you about the various things that I've been up to. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the podcast and it's a pleasure to be involved.
Well, I appreciate that, you know, with the reach of the internet and everything these days, that things go much further than sort of like our local community in the UK. But it's always nice to hear that it's reached the other side of the world. We've had a few guests on, of course, so unfortunately you're not the first from New Zealand to be on.
It's good to know that you know, some of the Kiwis have forged the way and overcoming time zones with this. Hopefully I can do the same.
Yeah, well, it's amazing what we've been able to do since with the advent of Zoom and super fast Wi-Fi, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, Dougal, you were introduced to me by Andy and Chris and the other guys at Precision Fuel and Hydration. You're one of their sponsored athletes. We've had quite a few conversations with those guys about their products and about some of their case studies. So a lot of the UK listeners might not be familiar with your name, although you are, you know, you're a big wheel in triathlon. And I know you're coming to do Ironman Wales this year, aren't you?
No, I did Ironman Wales, I think it was 2022.
Apologies. Okay, not too dissimilar to New Zealand, I guess, the terrain around there.
No, it was magic. I heard so much about it. I was doing the Challenge Wanaka event a lot when it was the full distance, sort of in 2014 to 2017 time. And when you fall in love with Challenge Wanaka, very quickly you hear about Ironman Wales, and it was cool to find out why. Very tough course. Amazing atmosphere, and yeah, a really cool experience that I was lucky to have.
How did you get on in Wales?
What a terrible race.
sorry for asking.
Yeah, no, it was a success in its own right. It, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about some of the other events I've done in the past, but essentially, I'd done a New Zealand event that was very close to my heart called the Coast to Coast in the February. Broken my ankle And as part of that rehab journey, I thought I really needed to set a goal that kept me, you know, on track. And that goal became doing Ironman well. So while the race itself, I think I finished maybe like eighth pro on the day and had my worst ever sort of marathon, it was a success that finally sort of made it back to a point where I could compete again.
Okay. I mean, the thing about Wales is that it's an experience, right? And I think, I don't know whether this counts for guys at your level where you know, it's your profession and you're, you know, wanting to win prize money and obviously you need to keep the income stream flowing. But for people like me and a lot of the guys I work with, it's the experience you have and the time you have rather than the time you do that's important.
Absolutely. And you're dead right. As I sort of stumbled when I tried to remember my placing, and I think it was what I do remember is, yeah, that quite support. I'd met Joe Skipper quite a few years ago in New Zealand, and we got on really well back then. So in the days before the race, I was trying with Joe, and obviously he'd made huge inroads since I'd last seen him. So that was awesome. And as I say, there's all these special memories around the event that actually sort of put the actual planning into sort of start perspective, really.
So let's rewind a little bit further then, Dougal. You've got a PE physical education degree, right? So have you always been a sporty chap, even when you were growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I was a very typical Kiwi sporting chap in that I played team sports, especially rugby and basketball and those sorts of things. I didn't really know what triathlon and multi-sport was growing up. I don't remember sort of knowing anything about it until perhaps sort of my final couple of years at high school. So, yeah, I was sporty, but in a very different way, as I say, with team sport and things. And then, yeah, I went to university and studied physical education. And I was always really interested in the place physical activity had in society and health and wellness and those sorts of things. Didn't really quite know why I was studying it and where it would take me, but I just knew that it was something I felt really passionate about. And yeah, it was actually while I was at university that I discovered endurance sport. I was playing rugby still and I was getting concussion, which, you know, we're talking probably 20 years ago, 2004. So yeah, exactly 20 years ago. And in hindsight, I now realize that concussion wasn't all that well understood 20 years ago. And I know there's still a lot to achieve in that space, but we certainly seem to know a lot more about it now than we did 20 years ago. So ultimately, it was my decision to stop playing rugby. And luckily for me, I moved pretty quickly into trail running and mountain biking. And one thing led to another. And yeah, I got into these sort of multi-sport endurance events.
Yeah, I played rugby when I was a student, and then when I, you know, like you, I was a sporty kid. I've just written a blog post actually for our podcast this week about shoulders, and the reason I stopped playing rugby was because I dislocated one shoulder, broke my collarbone, you know, and I just felt like if I carried on, I used to play wing forwards, and you know, there's a lot of tackling, a lot of trying to tackle people arm's length as they dodge past you. I just felt like my shoulders would be wrecked if I carried on. But I feel like, you know, the sort of player I was, I used to be able to dive on the ball in, you know, if it was on the floor. You can't do that now, but I wasn't really bothered about where I put my head. And I got away lucky. I didn't have any head injuries, but I feel like I dodged a bullet, particularly with the stuff you've mentioned about concussion. Now it's just such a big topic over here. And, you know, with the, I know, obviously, you know, rugby's a national sport pretty much over in New Zealand. And, you know, the all the advances they've got now are huge. Yeah. But feels like for a lot of those players, it's a bit late. I think I watched the All or Nothing documentary about the All Blacks. And one of the guys, I can't remember his name, he was one of the, he was either 12 or 13 that had to have a full season off because of head injuries.
That's right, Conrad Smith, I think.
Conrad Smith, yeah. And that was quite sad watching him because he'd get back to playing and then he'd get a knock again and then he'd have to have each time he had to have a bit longer off and he missed a whole season of Tri Nations and was trying to get back for the World Cup.
I just remember the frustration because, you know, even with, say, your shoulder or virtually any other injury, you can touch, see, feel, you know, there's a really tangible ability to gauge the seriousness and the, you know, the process that needs to then take place to return to competition, where, you know, for me, it was frustrating because you go, well, I don't actually know how bad this is. My brain's sort of hidden away inside my skull and I don't really know the extent of it. So it was, yeah, it was a really tricky period for me, for sure.
And of course, you know, you're not out of the woods as far as concussion is concerned, because as a cyclist, if you come off your bike, there's a good chance you're going to smash, you know, hit your head on the ground. And even with the protection of a helmet, that you know, concussion is a very relevant and real problem for cyclists as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And interesting you say that, because 2 years ago, I was trialing for this Emirates Team New Zealand role that we'll talk about later as a cyclore, and I came off my mountain bike and knocked myself unconscious. And it was the first time since playing rugby 18 or years before that I was back in the situation where I was trying to rehabilitate from a concussion. And what was amazing was how much better understood that whole process seemed to be for me from the medical staff. You know, like, I was taken to a medical center and assessed at the time, and the nurses and the doctors all had pretty robust advice on the next few steps, almost like a first aid process. Here's what you do for the 24 hours. Here's what you then do for the next week. Here's what you definitely don't do in that time. And yeah, it was really interesting, but yeah, certainly rather it didn't happen, but as with any injury, I suppose you sort of learn a lot through that process. And I was lucky enough to be back in action a few weeks later.
Yeah, I had an athlete who'd had a similar issue when they fell off the bike, and I found the return to play protocols that they use in rugby, and I was thinking, well, it doesn't matter what sport you're in, really, head injury is a head injury, right? And I was quite surprised about, okay, no, even gentle aerobic exercise for the first few days. You know, you don't want to create any sort of increase in blood pressure or blood flow above normal. You don't want to create any temperature changes. That was quite surprising, and not just for me, but for them, because they were thinking, well, if I just sit on the exercise bike and pedal, what harm can I come to? But apparently, you're probably better off not doing that at all for a few days.
Yeah. I was probably 3 days, I think, from memory, of nothing at all. In fact, I was lying in bed with the curtains drawn because the sunlight was sort of quite, you know, was irritating my head. I suppose it was giving me headaches and things. But what was quite cool was my doctor's a triathlete himself, and he said, you know, after 3 days, even if you feel really groggy still, you can climb on the watt bike, you know, stationary bike. Don't watch things, don't listen to music, just keep your eyes closed and turn your legs over. So the actual brain stimulation was very limited, but the physical stimulation, you know, we all know that there's an endorphin release and it feels good to actually move and do something. So I was surprised how quickly I was able to do that. But as I say, I had to really make sure I didn't overstimulate my brain. And so I was sort of just sitting on a stationary bike with my eyes closed for half an hour.
That's a really interesting point you make about stimulation of the brain. A friend of mine had a traumatic brain injury skiing. I mean, it looked like an innocuous fall, but it's caused her a great deal of trouble for 5 or 6 years. And one of the most startling things was that any external stimulation, being in a coffee shop just with lots of noise from other people, the sort of stuff that we do all the day, and just take it as part of life, driving a car and the sort of the images and all of the trees and all the other cars and everything that sort of your brain's taking in as you're driving down the road, all of that stuff would overload her brain and make her feel really, really exhausted. So if she went to a coffee shop to meet a friend, that would be it for the day then. She couldn't do anything else. If she drove somewhere, after processing all of that information, she couldn't do anything else. Things are an awful lot better now, but it's taken a while, and it was quite alarming to me, just that what we process and we take for granted actually is a real, you know, just volume of information.
Yeah, and the cell phone, that was the other one for me, eh? Just looking at a cell phone screen in those first couple of days, I just couldn't do it. If I gave it to my wife and said, if there's any messages or emails that are important, can you just sort of read them out to me? But it did have me reflecting on how much screen time we do offer our brain when we are healthy. It's yeah, there's a lot going on there for our brains to absorb every day, eh?
Absolutely. And I know, I don't know if you've read Alex Hutchinson's book Endure. He
Well, I
talks
have.
about how 90 minutes of intense computer work can lead to physical fatigue. And they did this study where they had people doing tests to exhaustion. And when they did the second test, the group that had spent 90 minutes on the computer doing all these complex maths problems performed about 10% worse on the time to exhaustion than the group that hadn't done it and compared to the previous. And so, you know, when you're tapering for an event and you've got a bit more time on your hands, I know people at work tend to sort of, all right, well, I'll fill my time with this, but that's probably not a good thing.
No. Yeah. Amazing. It's not until your poor little brain's had a traumatic episode that you probably realize just how much energy it does have to put into day-to-day tasks.
Did when you had just sort of closing off this, when you had your brain injury and your concussion, did the doctors mention creatine towards you to you at all?
No, is the short answer. I've certainly become a bit more aware of that just in recent times, but not at the time. What? Yeah. So is that something like if you have an athlete now that has a concussion, would that be one of your first recommendations?
Well, I'm not fully up to speed on it, but I had a podcast conversation a while back with an English guy who lives on the west coast of the US, and his research is into brain injuries and in infants. But he's obviously there's a you know he's really interested in health and fitness, and he works out regularly himself, and so he's been looking into how creatine can offer some protection to the brain. And I think he said in the podcast, if you're a cyclist, it might be worth taking a low supplemental dose of creatine on a regular basis. So if you ever do have an accident like you have and bang your head, it does just offer a bit of protection.
Yeah,
So
interesting.
might be worth looking.
I'm covering my bases now with creatine because one of my challenges, and again, we can talk about this later, is actually with my role on the America's Cup boat, is actually putting on weight after 15 odd years of endurance sport. So creatine's been a big feature for me as I try and actually add lean body mass to my skinny little endurance frame.
Yeah, let's come back to that, because the closing part of my conversation with Dan Plews recently was that he's sort of retired now from Ironman distance races, and he said, I've taken up lifting, Simon, but he said it's really, really difficult to put weight on, even when I've reduced my aerobic training load.
That's interesting. I don't believe him when he says he's given up on endurance sport because he said it about three or four times and then he comes back and races
Well,
like a 8-hour Ironman.
yeah, I think he did that sub eight in California, and he wanted to have a fast Ironman. He but he had to put everything else on hold. You know, no business development, just family training, and just the work that needed to be done. So I think it, you know, the amount of training that's needed means that other stuff has to get parked. Now he needs to go back to developing his business. Now he might have some other goals when he gets to 45 and think, or gets over 50, can I be the fastest 50-year-old? Can I do this? So who knows? But for the time being, it sounds like he's trying to pack on a bit of muscle.
Yeah, interesting. He's known quite well to the Emirates Team New Zealand crew because he was their exercise physiologist in the last America's Cup, which that was successful in defending. So yeah, the Plues, he gets around. He seems to have his fingers in a lot of pies, as they say.
He's a Yorkshireman. We like to have our fingers on lots of pies.
Excellent. Yeah, very well respected.
Okay, well let's talk about some of your training and racing then, Dougal. So you've talked about your triathlon exploits, but were you a triathlete before you were an adventure racer? Because I, you know, you mentioned doing the coast to coast, which got a fair amount of whitewater kayaking in there. So that's a different skill set. Mountain running, another skill set, slightly different from running along the road.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was a multi-sport off-road multi-sport athlete first, and then I was an Ironman triathlete second, and then I went back to being a multi-sport adventure racer again. So triathlon sort of sits in a sandwich, I guess, between two sort of off-road careers. And I
Okay,
think I did
so So how does swimming fit in there then? Because that's you didn't mention whether you were swimming much when you were young, and swimming's one of those sports where you need to develop the skills and techniques at a young age so they're grooved in. It's much more difficult for older folk to pick up the skills necessary to compete at the top level.
For sure, yeah. And I was an adult. Well, I guess in New Zealand we're lucky because we learn to swim as children. It's compulsory in our school curriculum, but I certainly wasn't a proficient freestyler when I got into doing some triathlon as a young adult, essentially. I think I trained for my first triathlon at the age of 28 or 29. So, no, not a great swimmer. I think my debut Ironman, which I actually raced as a professional, I swam 1 hour, 3 minutes. So anyone listening to this will sort of, that'll give them some context to how my swimming was to begin with. I was training a lot with someone who'd be familiar to a lot of your listeners, Braden Curry, who's still, world-class, but it was frustrating because we both came from adventure racing backgrounds and we both started to swim. And he, as you know, he'll be first out of the water and Kona sort of level swimmer now. So, we were both putting in similar time in the pool and he just, picked it up a lot better than I did. But my best swim time was around 52 minutes, I think. So I got to a level where I could be in the mix somewhat. I was never an amazing swimmer, but there was certainly hundreds of, probably thousands of kilometers that got me from 103 to 52.
So let's talk about adventure racing, because I don't think we've had anybody that's been a real high level adventure racer. How do you fit all of that training in? Because I guess you obviously need to do a fair amount of running, you need to do a fair amount of biking, kayaking. But I've watched the Eco Challenge and some of those other things, and there's the horse riding is something that comes in there. There's mountain skills. You need to be. I think you need to be. Seems like you need to be confident in the mountains and pretty good with rope work and that sort of stuff.
That's right. Yeah, and I think adventure racing, by its very nature, you sort of expect the unexpected sometimes. I remember getting to an event in China where we were told we'd be inline skating and, there was always some sort of spanner in the works. So you're always trying to develop a skill at short notice and be proficient in a sport that you'd maybe not been exposed to before. So a lot of it was sort of simple problem solving, really, just trying to do the best you can at the time. But the core essence, I suppose, of adventure racing is, I sort of just describe it as off-road triathlon because it's mountain biking, trail running and kayaking, often whitewater rafting, depends on the sort of the landscape that you're traversing for the event. And these days, a lot of pack rafting too. That was the sort of core essence. As you say, there was always a lot of sort of rope work, whether that's abseiling or rock climbing or caving or something like that. So that's sort of essentially adventure racing. And the way I sort of define, in New Zealand, we call it multi-sport, would be the coast to coast. So you're competing as an individual. And adventure racing, we sort of describe as the team aspect of multi-sport, where you'd typically be traveling with three other teammates. So teams of four. Adventure racing, usually the wording and the rules is at least one of each gender. So again, traditionally, your top adventure racing teams would be three male, one female, and often multi-day as well, either stage racing format, similar to the likes of, say, the Tour de France, where you'll race for a day and you'll pull up at a hotel, eat, sleep, shower, start again, or what they call expedition racing, which is basically get yourself from the start to the finish and, stop and sleep and things as and when it suits you. So that's sort of a brief synopsis on multi-sport. Mm-hmm. Stage adventure racing, expedition adventure racing, all three of which I've, forged a career in. So there was plenty of variety.
I remember watching the Eco Challenge and some of those other races. You've got a real pedigree of top adventure racers coming from New Zealand, haven't you? I remember there was a guy, is it Nathan Farve was one guy that I remember. Ian Anderson was another guy that I met. There was a couple of really prominent female racers as well. I can't remember one of them. One of them did a blonde-haired girl who finished in Kona, actually, 1 year.
Oh, and she's done adventure racing too.
I think she was a Kiwi. Maybe I'm wrong there. Yeah. I know there was a bit of a cloud around her because of some drugs issue that I recall. It was always
disputed. She wouldn't have been a Kiwi, surely not.
But they and I remember, so there was always the Kiwi team with Ian Anderson was one, and then there was the there was a top team from Finland as well. I think they were sponsored by Nokia.
That's right.
With the other guys, and that was always a bit of an epic battle when you watch the programs with those two teams racing.
Yep. No, and Team Nike from the USA, Mike Closer, he raced well into his 50s, I think. Very competitive.
Yeah, Mike Closer. And who was the there was a top world-class mountain biker that used to race as well.
Oh, and Team Nike. Yeah, that's right. They had a really good female who came from Xterra, I think, that became a big part of their makeup. But
okay.
Yeah, a lot of this the legends of the sport, a lot of it I was sort of learning in hindsight, which was, because I came into the sport when I did, it was all stuff that I was hearing in hindsight. But Nathan Favre, I was lucky to race with. We went to Brazil and did an event called Eco Motion, and, to see firsthand, he'd be arguably the greatest adventure racer. I'm biased because I'm a Kiwi too, but I think he's won something like 6 world titles and raced across a huge, 30-year period. So, yeah, I've been very lucky to race with people like him and, as I say, see firsthand what it takes to be good in a sport that can take 130, 150 hours to get from start to finish.
I think, was it Mark Burnett who was the founder of Eco Challenge? He was the one who got it all. You don't see so much of it on the telly these days, but he did really well in getting those things videoed and filmed and broadcast, didn't he?
Exactly. It essentially gave birth, I think, to reality TV, because most people would know Mark Burnett as the, the Survivor series. But prior to that, as you mentioned, was, the Eco Challenge, which, as you say, it became a really sort of popular insight into human suffering and, competition and essentially what then led on to all these reality TV shows that we now see.
So how would your training day be broken down then, because as a full-time athlete, I guess, you're training sort of 5 to 8 hours a day. Would that be about right?
Yeah, it always depended a little bit on so many moving targets at the time, because I was sort of trying to make a career out of a couple of sports that weren't typically the sorts of sports that supplement a career. So, yeah, I would usually be holding down a part-time job as well, but a big day for me would be in that 5 to 8 hour range. But of course, that wouldn't be a typical day. I think a typical day for me would have been more in that sort of 2 to 4 hour range. But when you're training for 3 or sometimes 4 sports, inevitably that volume would sit anywhere from sort of 25 to 30 hours a week, I suppose. And a part-time job might have been another 20 to 25 hours. So they were busy days, but I suppose a lot of that was happening prior to kids, of course, too. So when you thought you're busy and then you have children and become a parent, you realize what busy really is.
Yeah, and that's another layer of challenge, right? And there's certain things that you can't drop if you're a professional athlete. You can't really cut back on your training. You definitely can't ignore your kids or your wife. You've still got a job to do. So I guess things like sleep get a bit more compromised.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I sort of rationalized it in a positive way in my mind when I was doing adventure racing. When I became a parent, I thought, oh, well, this is good training for sleep deprivation. But as we all know, sleep is pretty non-negotiable when it comes to recovery and performance and things. So I had to be a little bit selfish at times and park myself in the other room while my long-suffering wife did all the nighttime feeds and things. But it was actually part of my shift into Ironman triathlon came when I became a parent, because for me it was a slightly more structured sporting approach where I could, swim, bike, run on a slightly more regular schedule. And that sort of, as I say, that was part of what led me into the world of Ironman long distance triathlon racing in sort of 2014.
It's kayaking. We often talk about open water swimming as being a, the stroke that's required for open water swimming is a bit different to the pool. And there's a lot of triathlon coaches refer to it as a polo or a kayak style, because you really want one arm to be recovering as the other arm is creating some sort of propulsion in the water. Whereas the glide stroke that you often see with pool swimmers isn't really that useful if you're in choppy water. So do you find that the kayaking action helped you learn to be a better swimmer, or was that not really relevant?
No, I think it was certainly relevant. There was definitely some crossover, and even just that general awareness of the place technique has in a sport that's as technical as swimming and kayaking. Even things like maybe a little bit more sort of shoulder robustness, where when you sort of don't come from, say, kayaking, you pick up swimming, you've got to be very careful around that, you know, progression with mileage and things. But coming from kayaking, I think that helped me accelerate my swimming volume maybe quicker than someone that didn't come from kayaking. And again, I think back to Braden Curry, who came, as I did, from sort of a kayaking background before he started swimming. And, you know, he's a very extreme example, I suppose, of where you can go to with your swimming if you start as an adult. But I'm sure kayaking played a bit of a part in his ability to progress so quickly in the water too.
I think when, you know, one of the things that helps you go fast as a swimmer is obviously reducing the drag. And where I find that most adult swimmers and triathletes struggle is that maybe they're a bit tight in the hips because they spend a lot of time sitting down and you're hunched over the bike. You sort of, you know, everything's in that sagittal plane as you're running. So it's very difficult for them to get that lengthy body position. That must also be a challenge if you're sitting in a kayak for several hours a week, because you're very definitely got a 90-degree flex of the hips, haven't you, when you're sitting in a kayak and fixed in that position?
Yes, you're dead right. And I think I've reflected a lot on some of those things, and I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. I think years of cycling and kayaking really, I've talked about how, you know, kayaking helped with swimming in some respects, but I was a sinker. Like my feet sat very low in the water, and I absolutely believe what you've just said is true, that my hip flexors were so tight that I couldn't really achieve a good streamlined position. And when I think, and again, I'll mention his name, Braden Curry, he is hypermobile. So he's had physios basically say your joints are far more naturally mobile than a normal healthy joint. So his ability to achieve streamline was probably helped by the fact that he had really good hip and ankle range, where I've always been quite tight through my hips and ankles. So yeah, I think you did right. My streamline position was probably hindered a lot by hours and hours of kayaking and biking.
Yeah, training for multisport and racing multisport is always a compromise, isn't it? And I, you know, talking to the Brownlees, they've come from a fell running background, and there's a stiffness that we talk about in the muscles that allows you to absorb the impacts. It's not the same as a stiffness where you've got like a range of movement, but there is a little bit of that. And from running downhill fast, you definitely need stability and that stiffness around the ankle. So being hypermobile in those two joints, like you talked about with Braden, might also be a disadvantage in certain situations.
Yeah. No, it's true of so many things, isn't it? The coast-to-coast mountain runners, a lot of it's crossing quite rocky riverbeds and things, but you're also spending time running through forests where there's low-hanging branches and things. So that's another good example of pros and cons. So I'm sort of a slightly taller athlete. I used to curse my higher center of gravity running across all the rocks because I felt quite clumsy compared to some of the shorter athletes. But then, you know, you get down the other, and also running through the trees and things, I'm having to duck further. But then you get down the other side and run along this really flat valley where my stride length becomes an advantage because I've got longer limbs and things. So it's funny how, yeah, your attributes can be an asset in some context and a hindrance in others, but it's probably all part of the fun, really, eh?
So you've started off in adventure racing or multisport racing, then you went to triathlon, and then you know you still do your adventure racing and multisport stuff. What's your favorite type of racing?
Well, I think my heart was always more in the off-road format. I did really love the solitude around training and racing individually, but if I had to choose, I think being part of a team was where I really found my happy place. And yeah, I've been really lucky, as I say, to race with lots of really amazing athletes. And I think being part of a team, you just get so many more learning opportunities. You can push yourself that much further because you've got people around you. And if I had to choose, I think team adventure racing's probably given me the most memorable sort of highlights when I reflect on my career, for sure.
And I think, I've done a few years ago, did a two or three adventure races. And one of the things I noticed was that, like with most teams, really, you can have some outstanding individuals, but if they're in an adventure race, you all need to finish each, section together, don't you? There's no benefit to one person being miles ahead. So you have to be good at working in a team. You have to be good at, we talked about compromise there. You also have to compromise sometimes on your philosophies and values in order to accommodate somebody else's. And that was the thing that struck me about some of those TV programs we talked about, was it wasn't always the fastest team that won. It was the teamwork and the communication and cooperation and collaboration between team members that was often the deciding factor.
And when I raced in Brazil with Nathan Favre, I remember flying over there and I was so nervous because he was just this incredible athlete, world champion, and I was sort of relatively new to the sport, and I was flattered that he'd invited me to come and race, but I really just didn't want to mess it up. And we started this race and we're running along this coastline in Brazil, and I'm still kind of trying to put the nerves aside and focus on the task at hand. And Nathan turns to me and says, "Dougal, how are you feeling?" And I thought, oh, I better make sure he knows I feel all right. I don't want to let him down. I said, "I feel great, mate." He goes, "Oh, fantastic. Can you carry my pack?" So straight away, I had this realization. I thought, hang on a minute. He's a world champion, not because he's invincible. He's a world champion because he will always consider what's best for the team at that time. And he was obviously struggling early in the race to possibly, there's 20 years between us. So I'm this young, youthful, enthusiastic athlete springing along the beach in the first couple of hours. He's sort of probably going, "God, this pace is probably a bit much for me." And he, as I say, he's a world champion because of his ability to think what's best here. And he doesn't have an ego. He's willing to sort of put his backpack on me for the good of the team. And I think that's the other thing I really loved about that sport, was there weren't big egos, because success came through, being able to put an ego to the side and put the team first, which was, that moment stuck out to me around this world champion passing me his backpack to help him sort of carry his weight a bit easier.
Yeah, I remember we did this race. It was a team of four. And like you mentioned, we had to have at least one female in the team. And we got this girl who was winning her age group at Ironman, and she was a very strong athlete. We also had another guy who was a great kayaker, but he was probably 10 years older than everybody else. And as we were doing I think we had to do, there might have been a kayak to start with, and then a trail run. And during the trail run, the older guy went over on his ankle. So now we had to, really help him get along. So carry his pack, nurse him along, get him to the next stage, which was a longer kayak. Well, this girl was like, "Come on, we're getting behind these guys. We're getting behind." And like, "Yeah, but we need to make sure he stays with us. Otherwise we're all dropping out." Yeah. We'd get to a checkpoint and the other teams would be just finishing up, having some food and getting on with the next stage. And she was saying, "If we don't rest here, we can catch them up and overtake them." But obviously he needed to rest. So for 2 days, she was on at him. Right, come on, you're keeping us back. Got to the last stage, which was really long kayak through the Caledonian Canal and out onto Loch Ness. And she was absolutely shattered. And she said, I can't get in that boat. And he said, "We're getting in that boat, because that's the finish at the other end. I'm not getting in. I can't. I'm going to drop out. If you drop out, we're all out. I'm going to put you in that boat head first, and I'm just going to paddle on my own if you don't get in that boat." So for 2 days, she was on his back. She was the one who wanted to drop out. And, but it caused friction throughout. There was this constant sort of cloud hanging over us of these two going at each other. And it made it a really challenging experience, as well as the event itself.
Yeah. And it's always hard if you haven't raced with those people before, you know, it can be really, it can be a bit of a gamble as to whether those personalities and dynamics are going to work. But I think some of the best teams in the world have become so successful because they have consistently kept that same combination and you know, learnt to work to each other's strengths and things. So, always hard when you haven't spent time racing with other people before.
Yeah, and I guess when you're looking for a new team member, it's not just right who's the fastest. It's, you know, what sort of personality they got. Are they going to fit in with the rest of us? That's probably more important.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There are some athletes out there I know that they love training, and then racing is just an opportunity for them to express all of that fitness. But they really, they race so that they can get all the training done. And then there are other people who put up with the training so that they can race. What sort of athlete are you, Dougal?
I was certainly always a trainer. I love to train. And early on, I loved to race as well. But it was interesting towards the end of my career, sort of right up until 2022, I was still racing. And I loved training as much, if not more, than I'd ever loved it. But the process of getting up for race day was becoming increasingly hard for me to find that kind of real, you know, when you're on the start line of an Ironman or any sort of endurance, if you're not fully up for it, you're going to get found out, because at some point, you know, the big questions will be asked. And if you haven't got that deep resolve, things aren't going to be pretty. And that's where I'd sort of found my way to. And I'm not quite sure, it might take me a few more years to sort of reflect and understand why things had got to that point. But to answer your question, training was always my biggest passion. I just loved to train. And that, you know, I often said, actually, even right towards the end, that, and through COVID, of course, when all the racing was getting cancelled, that I would continue to kayak and bike and run, maybe not so much swim, but I would continue to do those things because I just simply love doing them. So very much a trainer.
Yeah, I've heard the same said about Kylian Jornet, that he races so that he can train. And I found that quite interesting to start with. And then when I reflected on it a bit more, I thought, actually, I'm probably the same. You know, I love the process of going and swimming with my mates, and I'll push myself hard. I love riding my bike, and I'm really getting into gravel riding, which I'd like to chat about in a sec. But I've never really been, you know, brilliant with the running, but I enjoy running through the woods and just losing myself in mentally, you know, and just floating through the woods and focusing on that. But I've, like you, I've never really had that thing where I got super up for racing. You know, I did races as my own personal challenge, but I continue to train regularly now, and people ask me, well, why are you doing it if you don't race? And that probably answers my question, that this is what I love more than the racing side. Whereas you probably have friends as well who'll say, oh, I love racing so much, I love it. And they that really turns them on, and the training is a chore.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know, you might have a feel for this, but how that sort of split, like, would you say there's an even split between races that train, trainers that race, or are you seeing more in one corner than the other?
I've never explored it, Dougal. Maybe that's something I'll poll my tribe on and see which they are.
Fascinating. It'd be very fascinating. Like, in, I think of, like, Braden was always a racer. Sometimes I would be, you know, early on we trained together quite a bit, and I'd be dragging him out the door because he wasn't that interested in training to the same extent that I was. But on race day, you know, on his day, no one could beat him because he just lived for racing. So yeah, I'd just be really interested to know how sort of evenly split the two populations would be.
I'll do a little survey and I'll get back to you on that one.
Thank you.
Did you ever race in Kona?
I didn't, no. The Challenge Wanaka event, because I lived in Wanaka, was always my bigger focus in the summer. And Ironman New Zealand was usually only a few weeks later. So Challenge Wanaka obviously wasn't a qualifying event for Kona. And that was where I really invested my effort and my time. And I won it a couple of times. And I think my best placing in Ironman New Zealand was about fifth, which was never a Kona qualification. I was runner-up at Ironman Sweden and Ironman Western Australia, but I'm from memory, in both races, there was only one qualification spot for Kona. So, yeah, however way you want to look at it, I can offer all the excuses in the world. I just wasn't quite good enough to get to Kona.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a triathlete, it seems to be the holy grail for anybody doing long distance stuff. And I know a lot of people who go back, mostly because they want to beat their performance, not because they love the island or they love the race. Because it's, you know, if you've been there, it's a great swim and you can look at the coral and watch the fish. But once you get out of the ocean, it's a pretty boring bike and it's not the most exciting run. And this, you know, the challenge for people who don't come from hot and humid places is the heat and the humidity. So there's better places to race Ironman events, that's for sure.
Yeah. Always tricky for the Kiwis too. I mean, it's a decent trip, but like we're at the bottom of the world, so everything seems a long way away. But huge respect for the Kiwi contingents that train through the winter, you know, like not everyone can access proper sort of heat acclimation work leading into Kona. But essentially they're traveling from winter to race in one of the hottest parts of the world. So
yeah,
any Kiwi that does well there, I'm in huge awe of.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope you're enjoying the show so far and learning a lot. If you aren't already a regular listener, I hope you feel you might come back. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so you know whenever a new episode arrives. I publish these twice a week, ad-free, and with the mission of improving the health and performance of endurance athletes around the world. And to help me, I'd love it if you could share the episode with one person you think could benefit. If you have a couple more minutes, perhaps you could leave me a review on your chosen platform once you've finished listening to this episode. Okay, let's get back to the show. So, gravel racing, I just mentioned that. I know you've got, we're going to talk about your current role with the America's Cup team, but gravel racing, is that a big thing in New Zealand now?
It's becoming a big thing. I've actually just got my first gravel bike a couple of months ago. And partly because, the training opportunities are probably a little bit better where I live, but partly also because the events are starting to really appeal to me more than probably sort of the road race events. It's become a big thing. And I was probably guilty at the start of the gravel movement of saying, well, why don't you just ride a mountain bike and really enjoy it? But I've finally come around to that way of thinking. And, there's no shortage on everything from sort of, you know, one day gravel events to the brevet formats and things like that.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure we'll see you at the front of the peloton there as well, Dougal, once you get into it.
Yeah, we'll see what happens after this America's Cup campaign, because I think I'm about 12 kilos heavier than I was as an endurance athlete, which has been part of the requirements of specializing in the cycle or role. But I think I'll find it a bit of a fright the next time I actually have to ride up a big hill in a racing situation.
Well, let's talk about the America's Cup. You mentioned it a few times, and the cyclore role. I have to confess, when I first heard about this from the folks at Precision Fuel and Hydration, I was like, cyclore, what on earth is that? It sounds like some sort of Terminator character from a Marvel comic. The America's Cup, let's give people, for those who don't know, let's give people an idea of the America's Cup first.
Yeah, so, I mean, a disclaimer here is that when I got into the team 2 years ago, I really didn't know much Kiwi, because we've won the America's Cup, I think, about four times now. So I sort of knew about the America's Cup, but I wouldn't have been an authority on speaking about it. Whereas now, you know, I've been in the team for over a year and learned a lot about it. And it's essentially the pinnacle of the sport of sailing, I suppose you could say. It's likened a little bit to Formula One motor racing because of the big role that design and innovation and even things like software development and things play in performance. And so the America's Cup traditionally has been as much a sort of a design race, I suppose, as an actual sailing race on the water. So that's the America's Cup. It's got a rich history. I think it's about 140 years old. It took about 120 of those years for the Americans to finally lose it to the Australian outfit. I think that was in the sort of late 80s. And then, as I say, New Zealand have won it, I think, 95, 2000, 2017, and then the last one in 2021. So starting to develop a bit of a legacy, I suppose, of their own as a a small team relative to some of the bigger budget challenger teams around the world. And here we are hosting the event in Barcelona this year in October, which has been a big move for the team to pack up and move their base to the other side of the world.
Yeah, I was actually in Australia in 1986 when Alan Bond was the hero of the country, because he did take the America's Cup away from Dennis Connor, whose boat was called Stars and Stripes. And but there was a whole load of stuff then. You talked about the design that the Australians had a I can't remember the name of the guy, Ben somebody, but he was the designer who came up. He came up with this amazing design that, you know, the Americans were complaining about and saying it infringed all the rules, and there was all sorts of legal challenges, but they overcame it. And there was a massive party in Fremantle when they finally won. And so I remember it was on the telly, and I was captivated by these chaps that were sitting in this little pit, two of them that looked like bodybuilders. They'd got huge arms and they'd got, you know, bleached blonde hair from all the salt and the sun. And all they did was sort of spin these like a bicycle crankset backwards and forwards to get the sails up. And I was thinking, wow, that I wonder how much sailing experience they have, or whether they just sort of come from some sort of other power background. So I was reading about these guys and where they came from. I think there might have been a couple of Olympic sprinters in there, and then but they don't have the grinders anymore, do they? This is actually what the cyclo rollers are sort of become.
That's right. Yeah. So you know, the most people will picture the what you've just described, the hand grinder on a sailing boat. And traditionally they were effectively operating a bit of a winch system, so shifting the sails around on ropes and cables and things. And more recently, the role of the grinders have been to sort of pressurize hydraulic systems, which now are used to operate the sails. And it was actually Team New Zealand secretly in 2017, before going to Bermuda, that interpreted the rules as such that they could use leg power, and showed up at Bermuda and won the America's Cup back from Oracle, the American outfit at the time. And so that was sort of the birth of cycle oaring. Somehow the Kiwis kept it under wraps and won the America's Cup. I mean, there was a lot more to it than just the cycle oars, but that was where cycle oars were first exposed to the world, I suppose. And it took me a while to realize that cycle oar is basically cycle oar, cyclist sailor. So we're cycle oars.
Okay. It makes sense, I suppose, doesn't it? Because when you look at the physiology and the structure of a human being, the quadricep muscles and the glutes are the biggest muscles, and so they can take a lot more work. They fatigue a lot less quickly than the arms and the shoulders would. So over an event that's going to last, what, I don't know, is it 60 or 90 minutes now, the racing?
No, much less. It's usually between 20 and 30 minutes.
Ah, okay. So, but even over 20 and 30 minutes, I guess, you're not just putting the sail up and getting it down, you're making micro adjustments. And so there are, we'll talk about the sort of actual event and what you have to do, but yeah, it makes sense that you use the legs to do all that work.
Yeah, and as an extension to that, because you're absolutely right, but as an extension to that, and again, this was an initiative first introduced by the New Zealanders, was this concept of foiling boats. So essentially flying above the water. By using cycle oars, you can use less crew on the boat, less weight on the boat, and therefore more opportunity to get up and fly on the foils and lighter air and that sort of thing. So that's another advantage, I suppose, to using leg power over arm power.
Mm. So tell us about the selection process then. I mean, I guess they didn't come. Did they come to you and say, we want you on the team, or did you have to go to a sort of like a beauty parade and showcase your skills?
No, we all trialed. It was a bit of a shoulder tapping exercise, because for listeners of the podcast who will be probably more familiar with endurance sport and probably more specifically triathlon, power to weight is an important consideration, right? Where on the boat, it's ultimately, I suppose you could call it, absolute power that matters. So what they were looking for were trained cyclists that were big and powerful, and there's not actually that many that would probably fit that bill. You know, like cyclists are generally successful because of their, yes, their power is good, but they might be 60, maybe 70 kilos. So the trialists were sort of handpicked from sports where you've got bigger framed, powerful sort of engines. So rowers were a very obvious choice. There were some sort of endurance track cyclists. One of the guys in the team, Simon van Veldhoven, came from racing the Keirin. So, you know, he's sort of got a bit of everything, power and endurance and things. There's a bit of a mix that sort of got in the team. But basically, to answer your question, there was a really rigorous physical sort of training trial process that took place at the end of 2022. We did 20 minute. These are all on watt bikes. So we did the 20 minute, the classic FTP test, I suppose you could call it, maximal 20 minute average power. We did 30 second maximal sort of that anaerobic capacity. We did 6 second maximal, and we did sort of a race simulation type test, which was basically repeated sprints with minimal recovery. So it was I think I'm still recovering from the trials that were in December 2022. And luckily for me, I made the cut.
So whole range of power outputs there. What was your, did they give you the powers for those different durations?
Yeah. I can say right now I was hopeless at sprinting and still, you know, I've improved a lot, but I'm not like the purest sprinters that can push in that sort of 2,500 watt range.
Wow.
But, you know, where I got in was in that sort of 20 minute test, sort of mid 400s, I suppose, at the time. And I've managed to sort of put more on top of that now. But ultimately, they needed a bit of a range of qualities on the boat. So they needed those guys that could do the big sprint outputs. And then they also needed the guys that, a bit more like myself, that can hold that sort of good solid threshold power across sort of 20 to 30 minutes.
So how many cyclos are actually on the boat when the boat's racing?
There's four. So there's eight crew on the boat. Four of them are sailors and four of them are cyclors. So cyclors make up half of the crew on the boat.
Right. And as cyclors, then, based on what you were just saying a moment ago, do you have different roles, or are you all pedaling every time the sails go up or down or need adjusting?
Yeah, I sort of liken it perhaps, say, to rowing, where when you watch good rowers, they're really in sync. They're applying power at the same time, working sort of together. And that's sort of our goal as cyclors, is any maneuver that the boat makes, whether it's a tack or a jibe or a roundup or a bear away, where effectively the boat's doing a big U-turn, those are where the biggest power requirements come for us to deliver energy through the pedals. So partly it's about giving heaps of power, but partly it's also about contributing that power as evenly across the four of us as we can.
And are you reacting to a command from the captain then, that he'll say, I need power for 30 seconds, or do you need to have an understanding of sailing and how long you're going to cycle for?
A little bit of an understanding of sailing helps, because we are wired into the comms and we can hear the sailors communicating back and forth, so we know what's coming. And we've also, you know, we've got data in front of us where we can kind of anticipate what's needed and when it's needed and that sort of thing. So, you know, we've been sailing now for, you know, probably a good year or so. And we improve every time we sail, because a lot of it is sort of the ability to understand and anticipate what's coming and what the boat demands are, and therefore how we need to sort of pedal and when and by how much and those sorts of things.
So are you out on the water every day then as a team now?
In sailing blocks, we are. We're actually waiting. Our new boat for the America's Cup has been in the process of being put together. And so we're probably only a week or two away from actually launching that boat here in Auckland before we ship it off to Barcelona for the European summer. And so we're nearly at the beginning of about a 3-week sailing block, where basically every day that the weather's conducive, we'll be out there sailing.
And so when you're sailing, do you get much time to train as well? Or is that like a block of heavy racing, and then you have to have periods like you're probably in now of getting a lot of conditioning in to sort of get you through that next block of water time?
Yeah, definitely more the latter. So, because there hasn't been a boat to sail for a while, our cycle oars have had an opportunity to get really fit and healthy and strong. And then when sailing becomes the priority, it's probably a little bit counterintuitive to some people. To sit on a boat and pedal your butt off, you'd think is really good for your fitness, but it's probably, I like your analogy actually, a bit like doing a race block where, yes, you're putting a lot of energy into something, but the actual quality and I guess the ability to periodize how you're training is compromised somewhat. So sailing becomes the priority, and fitness, we're lucky to sort of try and maintain it through a sailing block, really.
Yeah, I think that would particularly for shorter distance triathletes, that are doing the WTS when they're going to Europe every week and doing the French Grand Prix stuff, and then they're going to the WTS events. I think a lot of observers will be surprised to know that actually isn't a time of great fitness. The fitness is declining over a season, so they have to have blocks of time when they top that up, and that's partly because just the high volumes that they do all the time. If you're traveling, racing, traveling, you get back, there's maybe a couple of days in between to get some training in, and then you're traveling again. Maybe your volume's cut down by 50% for an elite athlete. That's actually a detraining block. Even if you've got a 2 hour max effort in the middle there, you're still really detraining if you're not careful.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we sort of realized too that everything has to revolve around health. As long as we're healthy, we can perform. And so sometimes, when you are sailing a lot, it's tempting to get a couple of hours of aerobic riding on the bike, but are we actually better off having a massage and maybe, doing sort of more recovery-based stuff just to maintain health, eating well, all that sort of stuff, sleeping more. So yeah, we've sort of learned that as long as we're healthy, we can perform.
I'm really glad you said that, Dougal, because that's one of the little mantras I have when I'm working with the athletes that I coach. And none of those are elite athletes, but they have lots going on in their lives. And we always talk about, good health leads to good performance. So if you focus on the basics that lead to good health, you're nearly always going to get a better chance at hitting your goals. And if you put the training first and compromise on sleep and nutrition. So that was one of my questions, actually, was throughout your athletic career, one would assume that elite athletes have really good high performance human habits, really good sleep, really good nutrition, but it's not always the case. So what things have you purposefully done to improve your ability to recover from training and race well? And actually, how's that changed as you've got older and, particularly the having children and everything?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think something that I've been able to be quite consistent at my whole life has been sort of sticking to a reasonably good sleeping biorhythm, I suppose. My mum taught science at high school, and she was always on to us as teenagers about trying to be quite routine with your bedtimes and things like that, which is obviously pretty annoying when you're a teenager because you don't want to hear it. But eventually, with a little bit more life experience and wisdom, I could look back and realize that what she was saying had a lot of merit to it. So, I've always been fairly routine. I'm usually relatively early to bed, relatively early to wake up and get into training and things. So I think sleep's been a huge thing for me. Obviously, I don't like the word sacrifice because some people will say, oh, I've sacrificed social opportunities because of my sport, where I like the word investment. I've chosen to invest in a good night's sleep over, perhaps going out with friends until late at night and that sort of thing. So, some people might sort of think that's a bit of a boring approach, but the experiences that my sport have given me are far from boring in my mind. So I'm pretty happy with the life that I've chosen to live. But yeah, sleep, biorhythm, sleep, very important. Fueling something, I think your question was what sort of things have changed. I think I took fueling for granted early in my career and possibly could get away with it a bit more then, but definitely in the second half of my career, and even now with this new project and how important fueling is, that's something I've become a lot better at from I suppose, like you say, a high performance standpoint. achieving high performance has come a lot through that realization of how critical fueling is for performance. So between sleep and fueling, I suppose there's no big surprises there for people, but they'd be the big two for me for sure.
Mm. Yeah, I love what you said there about the overuse you hear from a lot of people about that word sacrifice versus investment. And I certainly have become more aware of this as I've got older, that for me now, sleep is an investment in my health as I get, you know, as I roll onto it until I'm 70 or 75. If I still want to be chatting with people like you and getting up early and riding my bike and going swimming, there's no way I can do that without investing in good nutrition. And it's definitely more critical when you're older. Your body's less it's less robust and less resilient, maybe more sensitive to different things. So you have to be more specific about your nutrition, but certainly than you were in your 20s when you could eat anything. And certainly for sleep, and I liken it as like a physical pension. You know, we all see pensions as an investment to enable us to enjoy our life later. Why wouldn't you do that with your fitness and your health as well?
Yeah, I like that. That's a great way to look at it. Couldn't agree more.
So, I mean, let's just touch on Precision Fuel and Hydration. You're on the other side of the world. I know they've got a presence in New Zealand, but did you just come approach those guys because you like the product, or did they come to you? Or was it, because I know Andy was doing a bit of adventure racing from time. Did your paths cross there?
Yeah, that's funny you say that, because Andy Blow, the founder of Precision Fuel and Hydration, he came out and did the Coast to Coast multisport mm-hmm. event in New Zealand probably about 15 years ago. And what I remember about that, he raced in the elite category and he deserved to race in the elite category. He was a very good athlete, but it's such a tricky course to do well in if you're not really familiar with the race. So, but what I do remember about Andy was he proposed to his now wife on the finish line of the Coast to Coast.
Okay.
That was my first exposure to him. I didn't know much about him other than that. But then I started using, I can't remember what it was originally branded, you might know, but the dissolvable sodium, you know, electrolyte tablets.
Yeah.
I think had a different name before they became Precision Hydration and now Precision Fuel and Hydration. I was using those tablets. They were a huge game changer for me with my cramping and performance.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that, and I was coaching a few athletes and starting to suggest that they use them, I was getting really good feedback. So I sort of passed that good feedback on to, as it turned out to be, Andy. I hadn't made the connection at that stage. And I'd done the Science of Hydration Training Peaks course. And anyway, it was just an email to say, you guys do an amazing job and an amazing product. And here's some real life examples of where you've career and some of the athletes I've worked with. And that was basically where the relationship have an interest in. And they sort of saw me as a worthwhile ambassador. And it's just been an awesome journey. I've probably learned a lot more from them than they have from me, but hopefully they've found my contributions useful.
Well, my recollection is that there were some dissolvable tablets, effervescent tablets on the market. And then Andy developed his, and the business was initially called Precision Hydration. And I knew Andy, as I said right at the beginning, before that. And so I got in really early with the little testing system he had, the sweat testing. And nice. I had one of the kits, and I had a little, you know, patch in Yorkshire that Andy said, you know, you look after this, you'll be the only person there. And I got all my mates in. And actually, what was really interesting was I was hearing some other nutritionists and scientists were saying, you know, this isn't a particularly reliable test. But what it did do was the folks who you knew sweated a lot, when you see black kit and you see the salt deposits on it at the end of a long race, those were the folks who were saying that they were cramping. And those were the folks who had quite a high salt concentration in the sweat. So there was definitely, you know, the tests were definitely consistent with the anecdotal evidence. And once we got them the prescription of the pH 1500s, they were then saying, actually, when I use these, I don't get my cramping anymore. It's not as bad. So, you know, to me, the dots were all connected. And so that was really good. And so I started pushing those products, but I was building my coaching business and I had a personal training business, and that was in the infancy of Precision Hydration. And it was just, I just didn't have enough time to concentrate on that. So I let that one go now to another guy who's doing it near me. But I've still kept in touch with Andy, and I still love the products. And we have a, you know, we have a relationship where I have a code and my athletes can get, you know, a better price on those. And awesome. The responses are really good. And of course, with these new chews that they bought out and the little gel packets with the little removable mouthpieces that you can move from one pack to another have been a pretty good innovation as well. I've really liked those.
Yeah, and they seem to really take feedback and apply it, don't they? They're just constantly evolving, and a lot of that comes through their the feedback they get from customers and elite athletes that they sponsor and coaches like yourself. So I think the other thing they're doing really well is empowering their customers with knowledge, eh? Like they've got a fantastic regular newsletter that is just full of real-world examples and information. And I think in the past you'd go into a cycling shop or a sports shop and you'd look at all this sort of sports nutrition and you just didn't quite know what it was, how to use it, that sort of thing. Where I think what Precision are doing really well is actually empowering you with the knowledge and understanding of how to use it, when to use it, that sort of thing. So awesome group of people to be involved with.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with the education bit. That's something that Andy and I have chatted about is, you know, how they, it's a crowded market, isn't it? Sports nutrition, and there's new products coming on the market every day. But what they've done is they've done it differently. It's very difficult to go outside the tram lines really with the products. So they've decided to approach it on the education front, and the case studies that they've got on the elite athletes and are excellent. The 15-minute phone calls that athletes can get to chat about their own hydration and nutrition requirements for a race have been invaluable for quite a few of the athletes that I've coached. And I think the important thing there is, and this isn't supposed to be a blatant plug for what they're doing, but the fact that they're not requiring you to buy the product, they're happy to chat with you for 15 minutes on the basis that, okay, quite a few of these people will come back and try the product as a result of that conversation. I'm like you, I'm really like what they're doing, and let's hope that they keep growing and keep innovating.
Well, we're off to Barcelona as a team from about June, so July, August, from my experience being there last year, frightfully hot climate. And when we're sitting on the boat, there's not a great deal of airflow when you're pushing what a lot of the listeners will know as FTP, or threshold or above threshold a lot of the time. So certainly electrolyte intake and fueling's just as important for me now as what it was when I was doing all these endurance events.
Well, you're in I've had a look at some images, you're sat inside an enclosed pod, so there's really only your head that's exposed, isn't there? So that must get really, really almost like a Formula One car, really. And just the heat build up in there must be pretty intense. Yeah.
Not to mention, we're wearing a life jacket and a helmet and earmuffs so we can listen to comms. So it's probably a bit like your athletes doing their heat acclimation work on Zwift with their jacket on and their heat pump going and those sorts of things. And no fan for that matter, because there isn't much airflow. So yeah, it's a hot little pain cave, that's for sure.
Do you know how much fluid you lose in each one of those races?
No, I haven't done, and it would be so easy, wouldn't it? You just weigh yourself, get on the boat, do your session, climb off it and weigh yourself again. So I will do that. But yeah, I'm guessing even in we'd normally do two sort of 20 to 30 minute segments before climbing off and having other cyclists climb in. There's enough for us to basically have two teams. I reckon in two sort of call it 30 minute sessions, I'd easily lose 2 to 3 kilograms, maybe more, in Barcelona in July when it's that hot. Yeah, easily, I reckon.
And have you got like a little mouthpiece in front of you then where you can drink while you're racing?
Yeah, we've got just a drink bottle cage. So we've got a drink bottle there, and we wouldn't normally sail more than say 40 to 45 minutes would be a long session before pulling up stumps. And, the support boat comes across and there's a bit of chat back and forth about various things on the boat. But for the cyclists, that's a fueling opportunity. So usually that bottle's been sucked dry by that stage and you're swapping it out for a new one. So there's that. We've been using ice vests a lot too. And it's like it, as anyone would know, if you even as simple as a fan versus no fan on Zwift, right? Like that can be 20 to 30 watts. So we're conscious that the less we can stress our systems from a heat standpoint, the more power in theory we should be able to deliver. So it's a challenge, but it's something we're very conscious of trying to address as much as we can.
Well, this is one of the things that becomes very apparent when you're racing in somewhere like Hawaii is how much of an impact the heat and humidity and the inability to sort of cool down has on performance, particularly on big guys. So, you know, that's going to have an impact. You just talked about the sort of climate that you're going to experience in Barcelona in the summer. So there's definitely going to be a lot of heat generated, a rise in body temperature, in core temperature. That has an impact on performance. And I guess what's your average heart rate during one of those 30 to 40 minute sections? Is it pretty high, or do you get a chance to relax?
It depends a lot on conditions. When it's windy, we get less sort of recovery because the sailors are having to trim the sails a lot more in higher wind. So on a windy day, we could easily come off the boat after 30 minutes at an average heart rate, say 10 beats below our maximum heart rate. So very high heart rates on those sorts of days. Obviously, it's not always that windy. In fact, more often than not, it'll be lighter wind. So in lighter wind, you know, you put a lot of energy into a maneuver, but then you get a bit more recovery when the boat's sailing in a straight line. So it sort of depends a bit.
Mm. Wow. So that's threshold and above for 30, 40 minutes. That's a proper FTP session, isn't it? And so let's talk a little bit about the specific training you're having to do. Not much time for kayaking or running then at the moment. It's just, I guess it's all just cycling and then talk about this other elephant in the room, the weightlifting.
Yeah. No, I've really enjoyed the new challenge, I suppose, and trying to become sort of a bigger, more powerful type of athlete. You know, we've all come into the team from different backgrounds, but for me, it was really important that I did add some body weight, A, to become hopefully more powerful through the pedals, but B, to sort of level myself up more with my teammates, because as I said earlier, there's four on the boat, but you could race twice a day in the America's Cup. So potentially you'd do one race, you'd climb out of your cockpit and your teammate would jump in and replace you with fresh legs for the second race. So, you know, if I'm 80 kilos and he's 95, well, that's going to completely affect the balance of the boat. So partly it's about trying to achieve a body weight that's similar to my teammates. And as I say, if I'm pushing a X number of watts at 80 kilos, well, in theory, I should push a lot more watts if I'm 95 kilos, sort of thing. So, yeah, lots of weight training, lots of eating, lots of creatine and protein, and, lower overall training volume from when I was training for three different sports. So no running. Obviously, if you're trying to gain weight, running's not a great thing to help you achieve that. Not really much else, to be honest. It's all about riding a bike and pushing the weights and just becoming as powerful over sort of a 30 minute period as possible.
Did you traditionally do any resistance training when you were at multisport racing or triathlon racing?
Yeah, I was really lucky. My initial coach, Val Burke from New Zealand, she was a big believer in strength training. So I'm a believer in it now too, but it was really her influence that grew my understanding and appreciation of the importance of strength and mobility work for endurance racing. So yeah, I was very lucky to have that influence right from the start.
I guess that the type of lifting you're doing now is a bit different. Are you doing lots of Olympic lifts?
Yeah, I mean, a mixture of some Olympic lifts, a lot of leg press, obviously. So the leg press is a bit of a staple in our diet. Quite a bit of sort of plyometric, you know, explosive type thing. So yeah, it looks quite different to what I used to do, and rep ranges and all that sort of stuff's probably a bit different too. But as I say, loving the sort of the new challenge, and I've been quite surprised, I suppose, by how much progress I've managed to make in a gym setting, given, you know, traditionally I might have done one or two a week, 30 to 40 minutes at a time. These days I might do sort of four a week and they might all be an hour at least, sort of thing. So big shift in the gym training space, but it's quite amazing how the body can adapt.
And You mentioned weight there, and you mentioned, I think, briefly that you've put on 10 to 12 kilos. So what were you before you started this training, and what are you now?
Well, I used to race Ironman professionally in multi-sport events at around 80 kilos. So it's been quite funny because I used to feel quite big, you know, like 80 kilos for a professional long-distance endurance athlete. That's a reasonably big kind of a dude. And now I've come into a sport where I feel really small because my kilos, you know, some of them are well over 100 kilos, some of these cyclists. So it's been a bit of a change in identity, I suppose. But, I'm now sitting kind of consistently at 90 or more kilos. And luckily it's also translated into a bit more power on the bike, because that would have been a bit of a shame if I put on all that weight and didn't improve my power. So ultimately the goal is to produce more power on the bike, and that's sort of something I've seen happen, which is cool.
That's a bit of a change in the wardrobe as well, isn't it? Because unless they're giving you all sponsored clothes.
Oh, it's funny you say that. My wife and I went for dinner the other night, and I don't really have all that much sort of nice clothing. And I scurried around in the wardrobe and found some dress pants, and I went to put them on, and I had no chance of fitting them. So it's funny when you're doing something day in and day out, you sort of lose track of progress, right? And that was a real, actually, as frustrating as it was not to be able to fit in my pants, it was actually a moment to actually feel quite proud of myself, because obviously my glutes and things had grown to a point where I couldn't do the button up on my pants. So that was a cool little moment for me, really.
Yeah, but carrying around an extra 10 kilos, I mean, that's an extra 10, more than 10% in body weight. Does that feel uncomfortable to you?
Well, people ask me that often, and I think if I had to go for a run, I would absolutely feel horrible. But I haven't run. In fact, I haven't run since about 10 weeks before the trial at the end. So probably October 2022 would have been the last time I ran. Now, because I'm cycling, non-weight-bearing sort of a sport, I suppose I don't really notice it. And day-to-day, you know, like walking and things, I don't think I notice it, but running would be the one. Maybe on the other side of the America's Cup, when all is said and done, I might go for a run, and then I'll come back and tell you just how horrible 10 kilos feels.
Well, that'd be an interesting experiment, won't it? Not just because you'll be heavier, but even though you've been a runner and running most of your life, running's definitely a coordination sport, and you definitely notice, you know, if you've had your limb in a plaster or a boot for a while, how uncoordinated you feel. But having not run for 2 years, there won't have been any loading on those bones, so you're definitely going to have to ease yourself back in gently, otherwise you'll end up with another challenge.
Yeah, you're right. I think I'll be an easy target for a lot of my friends too. They'll sort of see me as an opportunity to beat me in a running race, which maybe in the past they wouldn't have had a chance at. So, I might keep a low profile.
Just on going back to those high-performance human habits, are you using anything like the Whoop bracelet or an Oura ring to track heart rate variability or sleep or any of those other sort of metrics that perhaps are not as easy to notice?
HRV for training, I use the app on my phone. So I do that every morning when I wake up. But no, I mean, I just use a normal, watch for training and Garmin head unit and things. So all I really track is HRV and weight at the moment for obvious reasons. But I think for the purposes of what I'm doing, HRV probably tells the full story at the moment. So that's been the only metric, I suppose, we've been tracking.
And you know, I know there's a lot of science involved in the boats around the America's Cup performances, but obviously the fitness and the recovery of the sailors is also important. So is there any science that they've brought into your preparation that you've not been exposed to before?
I mean, there's probably lots of little idiosyncrasies that I've picked up on because, the sailors are world-class, not just as America's Cup sailors, but they're all, you know, Olympians. A lot of them are gold medalist Olympians and things. So lots of little bits and pieces along the way. But ultimately, and I know it's boring for people to hear this, it still just comes down to those big things, you know, the sleeping, fueling, the ability to sort of try and keep the rest of your life in sort of a relatively harmonious state so that there's not too much additional stress involved. And the pursuit of sort of sporting performance. But yeah, it's interesting. We've got Olympic rowers in the cycle or crew, ex-Olympic cyclists. We've got one of my teammates came from special services, military background. We've got these sailors that have all, you know, had success at the Olympics. So very different backgrounds. But quite often it's amazing how you come together and you all sort of share a very similar overall philosophy on what it takes to perform well.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that I'm always talking about is the basics. You know, Stephen Seiler, are you familiar with Stephen Seiler?
And the Yeah.
So he's done this thing. It's like hierarchy of endurance needs based on Maslow's hierarchy. And it's That's basically great. Frequency and volume of training on the bottom of the pyramid. And then, okay, just add a sprinkling of high intensity, but don't worry about when you do it. Just do it randomly. So you could be out riding your bike and you sprint up a hill or for a signpost. And then if you want to just get a bit more precise, just maybe add a structured session in once a week. But he said those, if you do those three regularly, that's going to get you 90% away. And it's the same. You could create another one for recovery, you know, get your sleep, get good quality nutrition and do that regularly and focus on your hydration, right? Those are the three main things. All the other stuff, tapering, peaking, altitude chambers, heat chambers, you know, HRV, they're the icing on the cake. But he lives in Norway and he always says that the Norwegians talk about you need to you have to spend a lot of time baking the cake and a little bit of time icing the cake. And that's exactly what you've said really there, isn't it? The baking of the cake's the more important thing.
Yeah. And I just love, you know, Stephen Seiler is a good example of, you know, decades and decades of research. And if anyone knows a thing or two about exercise and performance, it's someone like him. And quite often they do bring this almost underwhelmingly simple formula forward by the end of it all, eh? And say, well, it all boils down to your ability to eat well, sleep well, perform well. And it's quite comforting in a way because you can overcomplicate things in your mind, eh? And there's so many people out there, certainly ones with maybe a bit of a marketing motive that will tell you all these sort of things that will make all the difference. But at the end of the day, it's sort of, as you say, 1% is when you can get 90% of your performance through those sort of low-hanging fruit.
Just coming back to the weight thing, you mentioned about being quite heavy for an elite triathlete. I was listening to a podcast with one of the guys who works closely with Christian Blummerfeld. He's sitting at 80 kilos at the moment, so you're in good company.
Wow. I dare say 40 of those kilos are in his heart and lungs, eh?
Well, when you see him, he looks a lot stockier and chunkier, doesn't he, around the chest and the shoulders and a lot of the triathletes, but it doesn't seem to be of any detriment to his performance.
Yeah. I wrote a piece actually for the Precision Fuel and Hydration guys around that concept of what is the perfect body for triathlon. And I used the example of the two Norwegians, you know, Gustav Eden and Christian Blumenfeld at the time of writing were the two best triathletes in the world and yet had such contrasting shaped bodies, and sort of celebrated the point that at the end of the day, the perfect body is the body that's performing well for the task at hand. And it doesn't really matter what the shape or size is, it matters how the performance unfolds.
Yeah. Dougal, I'm conscious of the time over there in New Zealand at the moment. I really, really appreciate you staying up a bit later than you might do to chat with us today. And it's been a really insightful and informative conversation. So thank you so much for that. Best wishes with the remainder of your training and your trip to Europe and racing this summer. I'm going to feel like I've got more of a vested interest in seeing how the New Zealand team getting on now and hopefully seeing you there as part of that team. So yeah, best wishes with all that. And thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Simon. It's a true sort of role of honor when I look at who you've had on your podcast. So it's a huge privilege to chat with you. Well, I was going to say tonight, I suppose it's this morning for you, but thanks very much for having me and really appreciate you taking the time to hear a little bit about my story.
Thank you again to Dougal for being my guest on the show this week. I'm definitely going to follow up on that final discussion about whether folks prefer to train or race. I've realised that I am without doubt in that former group, so please look out for a poll I'll be running on my Facebook pages so we can see which one you fall into. Now, to make sure you don't miss any of our future episodes, please do go to iTunes or the normal platform that you choose to get this podcast from, and then search for High Performance Human Triathlon Podcast, and then click the subscribe button. And once you've finished listening, please could you share this episode with just one person you think might benefit? And that would be awesome if you could. And what would be doubly awesome is if you've got a couple more minutes where you could leave me a review on your chosen platform. Finally, please make sure you check out the show notes for links to all of the items I've mentioned above. And I'm really going to try hard to find a video of the cyclos at action so you can see exactly what Dougal's doing on board the boats when they're racing. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll have another great guest in 7 days' time, and I hope you'll be able to join me. Until then, happy training and enjoy the rest of your week.